This is News and Notes. I'm Tony Cox. On today's roundtable, President George Bush reveals what he expects to happen in Iraq this year. Five teens sentenced to prison for lynching, and the latest on the Alito hearings. Joining us today to discuss these topics from our bureau in Chicago, Laura Washington of the Chicago Sun-Times, a columnist there. Laura, nice to have you back.
Hi, how are you?
Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle, is at Spotland Productions in Nashville. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, good to be on board.
And last but certainly not least, George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service. He is at our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. George, you're going to be up first. Nice to have you.
Hello, Tony.
Here we go. President George W. Bush's speech to outline his plans for Iraq turned into a call for unity. While talking to the VFW, he told Democrats who are critical of his Iraq policy to temper their criticism or risk giving, quote, comfort to our adversaries, end quote, and suffering at the next election. So, George, what do you make of the president's tactic here, given the ongoing issues with the war? It's not clear if this is an offense or a defense.
I think it's pretty clear it's an offense, and it is also offensive that the president will go around basically going to tell critics, you know, either curb your language or you are part of aiding and abetting the enemy. I mean, that's just a classic discourse that absolutely is unacceptable. I mean, everything is fair game for discussion. It should be discussed, and you do it on the basis of ideas, not whether you express an idea and it's going to give aid and comfort to the enemy.
Laura, how do you see it?
Well, I think George is right. He's done with his apologizing. He is definitely on the offensive. About a month ago or so, in recent weeks, because he was on the defensive, he was, you know, acknowledging. He never said I'm sorry, but he was acknowledging maybe we made some mistakes. This speech now is basically saying we've made some mistakes, but we've learned from them and we're moving ahead. And anybody that doesn't get on board is not with the program and is disloyal. I think this is in many ways declaring war on the anti-war movement, in particular Democrats in Congress. He's reminding people that many of these folks who are now naysayers were also folks that voted for the decision to go to war. And so he's out there, and I think he's not going to take any prisoners.
Well, Jeff Obafemi Carr, considering some of the issues surrounding the Republican Party to date, how much heft is there to the president's words?
Well, I don't think there's a lot of heft to the words at all. And we talk about words and phrases that have been used by this administration. It has become quite skilled in the use of somewhat amorphous phrases that really could mean anything, whether it's spreading freedom or reconstruction efforts or building democracy and speeding the transition to democracy in the United States. These phrases don't really carry much weight with people now. Right now, the bottom line is the numbers, I think, for the American people. There are 30,000 plus Iraqis that have been murdered in this conflict. And of course, the figure we really like to care about, sadly, more than anything else, 2,200 plus Americans. I think it's time to set a timetable for withdrawal and stop picking fights with his own people.
Let's move on to another topic. Lynching. Five South Carolina teenagers pleaded guilty to lynching and were sentenced to prison. Now, lynching in South Carolina, we should point out, is defined as a mob attack in which the victim survives. The statute has nothing to do with race or people hanging from a tree necessarily, but given the state's history and legacy, many people can't probably help but think of Jim Crow, that era, and slavery. So let's talk about the crime and the punishment. Jeff, you're in the South. How did this impact you, and what has been the response of the people in the area that you have talked to about this?
Well, it's been a horrible response. I mean, I personally can't imagine the fear and the helplessness and rage that must have run through Isaiah Clyburn on that night. I've heard stories like this from Emmett Till to an unnamed relative of my own down here in Alabama in the 30s, who was never seen again after protecting a female relative from some white men. And it's deplorable that this type of mob behavior exists. But I'm going to step out here and say something that's brutally honest. A lot of this is the nature of the young America that we live in now. I work with a lot of juvenile offenders on occasion, and I'm telling you, the days of the simple fist fight is over. If there's a fist fight and you win fair, it's still not over. It just starts an insane cycle of standardized violent behavior. Somebody goes and gets mad, they go get some cousin with double initials and his crew, and there's a mob beatdown, and it's crossing the color line. I've seen black kids do this to each other, and we just live in a different world right now. It's distressing.
Does that suggest to you, George, that perhaps the punishment is inappropriate in this case, given what Jeff has just described?
Well, I think the punishment should have been stronger. I mean, the judge had it right when he called them despicable cowards. You don't get five people and then tell to one person who's isolated, oh, let's have a fight, and then to go back and, as one of them did, go back and brag to a female that he's hold up his class ring saying, this is why I hit him in the head. This is absolute cowardice. And the whole thing also reminds me of the James Byrd incident in Texas. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just coward. And the punishment should, the judge said he wanted to send a message. I don't think he sent a strong enough message.
Well, Laura, does it matter to you in terms of the age of these offenders? These boys were 17 and 18 years old, I believe, 16, 17, 18 years old. Does that matter in terms of their knowing what they were doing and the punishment that they received?
Absolutely not. I think it's, in fact, makes this case even more chilling. The fact that young people, as Jeff points out, have are learning through media and through their culture and lifestyle that this kind of violence is acceptable and even applauding. Jeff made the point that we live in a different world. I think this case reminds us, and in many ways, we still live in the same world that we did in the age of Emmett Till and the age of Jeff's relative. It's a chilling reminder of those dark days when lynching was considered an appropriate way to send a message to African Americans. I'm the Ida B. Wells a Barnett professor at DePaul University, so I've taken a close look at the whole issue of lynching because, of course, Ida B. Wells' legacy as someone who worked to stamp out lynching. And this is about sending a message, George's point about the ring. This is about sending a message about being celebratory, about having a souvenir. These are some of the same characteristics that you saw in the dark days in the 18th and 19th century. And these kids are doing this not just because they're destructive and violent, but because of racism.
I grew up in Alabama, and the thing that strikes me here is these are not people of my generation. I'm about to turn 59 next month. I mean, so I went to separate school, a separate water fountain, the whole bit. But this is a generation of kids who grew up under desegregation. They lived in the same neighborhood, some of them. Some of them had went to integrated schools. Most of them, all of them went to integrated schools. You would expect that we'd be much further along, and we are not. So I find it more troubling that they are that young and engaged in this kind of behavior.
All right, let's move on. Go ahead, Jeff. Go ahead.
Well, I'm just saying, I personally, and I understand what George is saying. I grew up in Tennessee, and I'm part of the first generation of those who were victims of integration. So we missed out on some of the unity that black people had in the segregated schools, but we also had to go through the utter dissonance of being in an environment where all of our parents and grandparents were saying, oh, it's so great you get to go to school together, but we still experienced this same kind of racism and nobody talked about it. So the mentality is still there.
You know, I was going to move on to another point, but you said something that made me think about another issue, and I want to go back to it before we move forward, and that's this. As I read about this, I was reminded, and I don't know why, of the Reginald Denny beating. I know completely different circumstances, and yet it was a mob mentality, blacks beating up a white victim. Any correlation in the minds of either of you between that incident and this one?
I think it's much more like James Byrd. Much more like James Byrd, where these people, a group of whites, tie this young man on the back of a truck and drive him through town as a sport and until he's decapitated. And so that comes to mind more than any other crime to me.
I think for me it's an issue of hate crimes too. As you pointed out earlier, the law does not mention race, but hate crimes are still very prevalent. Whether folks are killed, whether they're lynched, or in the traditional sense, hate crimes are still very prevalent in this country, and they're committed against groups, all groups, not just African Americans.
All right, let's.
And I wouldn't.
Go ahead.
Oh, great. I was going to say that Reginald Denny situation, I wouldn't dare justify that at all, except to say that on one hand, you're dealing with a whole city, a whole community that is up in rage, and everybody is a mob in essence, and he was a victim of that mob violence in general. On another hand, you're talking about a guy walking down a country road and guys passing by in a truck and threatening him for no reason at all, without any kind of extenuated circumstances that were similar to things that happened in L.A.
Let's talk about this next subject because it's in a sense related to what we're just talking about now. It involves a man who was here in California on death row. His name is Clarence Allen, and he is scheduled to die next Tuesday by lethal injection at San Quentin State Prison. Now, unlike some prisoners, he fully acknowledges his crime and he understands his punishment, but there are several reasons why he feels that the powers should reconsider. Number one, he's 75 years old. Number two, he's legally blind. Number three, he has diabetes. Number four, he is confined to a wheelchair. He served more than 20 years on death row, and he calls San Quentin's chronically deficient health care system punishment enough. So Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has to decide whether or not to grant a clemency hearing for him. Let's start with you, Laura, particularly because of the capital punishment issues that have been at the fore in your state of Illinois. How do you see this?
You're absolutely right, Tony. Illinois has been at the forefront of the anti-death penalty movement, and we, of course, have a moratorium in place right now because of we have at least 13 or 14 men who have been released from death row after it was determined that they were not guilty through DNA testing and other investigations. So this is clearly, I think, another step in the anti-death penalty movement. It's not so much a question for me as to whether or not he's healthy enough to die or whether or not he's atoned for his crimes. I think the movement's pressing the question whether this is a just law. And I think there's a lot of momentum that's developing in terms of what the Tookie Williams case and the publicity that got in terms of this case. And there are a number of places that are either looking at moratoriums or considering them. And in fact, California, even though the polls show that most folks say they're against the death penalty, most folks there are also in favor. I think it's the figure 73% are in favor of a moratorium.
Mm-hmm. That's right. George, what's your take on this?
First of all, I'm opposed to the death penalty, and if I were not, though, I wouldn't say that age and health should be reason to give to spare his life if that's what you believe in. One thing that doesn't get pointed out in the California cases of death row is that no one on death row in California is there where the victim was a person of color. And what is interesting is slightly more whites on death row than blacks and Latinos, almost evenly divided. But that tells me more than anything else that the value of a black life is not equated with that of a white, that no person who on death row is there for killing a black person. And that's one of the larger issues that need to be addressed.
Jeff, what's your take?
Well, Clarence Allen is 75, blind, in a wheelchair with diabetes, a stroke, and two heart attacks in his back pocket.
That's
and
right.
I wouldn't want, as an executioner, a governor, a warden, or a judge, to have to approach whatever afterlife I may believe in with the execution of an old crippled man on my record. The Supreme Court has made exceptions for eroded mental status. But if you're asking my opinion, having to wither away slowly with only the San Quentin Prison Hospital, where they aren't exactly winning any prizes for medical care, as my only sustenance should be punishment enough at this point. And it calls into question the validity of this whole death penalty thing.
Let me ask the three of you to chime in on this aspect of this issue, and that has to do with the fact that in the South in particular, what about the former KKK members who were, you know, caught and convicted in their elder years? Do you feel the same way if this guy were one of those people?
I don't, and that's why I disagree. I mean, I don't care how old they are. Unfortunate thing is got along that often. I mean, got away that often. I mean, those cases should be brought to justice, and they should rot in jail and rot in hell afterwards. Mm-hmm. And so I don't use it as an excuse. I mean, it just shows the flaw in the system that they were able to get away that often, and I don't think that any special dispensation should be given to them or this person if you believe in capital punishment.
We can't get to
the death penalty until we can make sure that we have just prosecutions. And George is right. There are so many cases out there. The Emmett Till case we discussed earlier is one of them, where we haven't even been able to bring just prosecutions in cases of like this. So we do have a broken system we need to fix.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, you get the last word.
Yeah, with the advent of medical technology, forensic technology, it's exonerated many people who find themselves wrongly convicted. I don't think we can take a chance on being wrong, especially when we're dealing in the invaluable and irreplaceable commodity of human life. And I would agree with George. If you catch these cats who were doing things in the 60s and 50s and hurting people, I would rather know that they're rotting in jail than to give them an easy out of death.
You know, it's interesting. You guys have been agreeing a lot more lately since I'm not used to you guys all agreeing as much.
We have to work on that.
You've been doing. You know, we gotta have a meeting after the show. Get that straight.
We're free thinkers. Point
number four, our final one of the day. We've got a couple of minutes left. We are into day three, of course, of the confirmation hearings for Judge Samuel Alito. First thing, really simply, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being best, how's he doing?
Depends on your perspective.
All right. Well, on your perspective, how's he doing?
Well, he's doing fine. If you're looking for confirmation, I think he's likely to get it. This stuff is so scripted. I mean, go to People for the American Way site. You know, they had laid out the script in terms of how it was going to happen. He's going to talk about family, and he's going to talk about having an open mind. And, of course, no judge is going to go up there and say, I got a closed mind. He's saying all the right things he needs to be said to get confirmed, and I think he will be.
You know, if I'm a Republican,
about a 7 or an 8.
Okay, well, that's cool. All right, 7 or 8. You say, what do you say, Laura?
I give him about an 8.5. I think that a lot of people weren't expecting him to perform as well as John Roberts, for example, to not be a slick. Mm-hmm. He is not a slick, but in many ways that's made him endearing. And we're dealing with a partisan debate here. Nobody believes that, you know, that anybody's going to change their minds on this guy. It's all about politics.
Well, then you would agree with this statement then. If I'm a Republican, I'm feeling pretty good right now because he took the Democrats' best shot and really didn't blink on abortion, reapportionment, executive privilege, even the recusal issue, right? Right? Republicans should be feeling pretty good.
They should be feeling pretty good. They've prepped him very well, and they've led him through the discussion, the debate very well.
So now, does this mean, as the Democrats, does it mean that you have lost because what you thought you would be able to do in terms of derailing his nomination is not going to happen, or perhaps you have discovered that he is not, you know, the problem that you thought he was going to be? We've got less than 40 seconds or so. So, George, I'm coming to you on that.
He's more than the problem. When he tell you dissent, and 91% of your dissents are different from the even conservatives appointed by a Republican president, you have a problem with his record. But the fact is that, you know, it's not about the record in a lot of ways. It's all about theatrics and how you present yourself. And he's following his script.
He's done well so far.
Yeah.
All right, we'll have to keep watching. In Chicago, Laura Washington, Chicago Sun-Times columnist. Jeff Obafemi Carr, host of the radio show Freestyle at Spotland Productions in Nashville. And George Curry, editor-in-chief of the National Newspaper Publishers Association News Service in Washington, D.C. Thank you, folks.
Thank you, Tony.
Thank you.
Have a good one.